Hey everyone, I'm Jason V, and this is Local Color, a Baltimore podcast. My guest today is Willie Flowers, Executive Director of Park Heights Community Health Alliance in West Baltimore. The Alliance is a nonprofit that provides the residents of Park Heights with health and wellness initiatives such as Project Yes Yoga and a weekly CSA that gives them access to healthy local produce. Willie, welcome to Local Flowers. Sorry, I messed that up. Welcome to Local Color. How you doing?
Hey, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I know last week you were at the Marine Corps Marathon. How was that?
It was great, man. It was my first time doing it, and it was my first time doing two marathons in a row. I did the Baltimore Marathon the week before, so it was a new experience for recovery.
Yeah, so. I live on Guilford Avenue, so you probably ran by my apartment.
Yeah, that's one of the hits. It was both marathons had good weather, and it worked out in that regard. And even the Marine Corps Marathon actually had a little rain in the beginning, so it cooled things up enough to get warm along the way.
Oh, gotcha. How did you feel? My friend, he's run a marathon before. He said after a while you just kind of hit a wall, but you gotta work through it.
Yeah, this is my 11th marathon with this Marine Corps Marathon last week. So I've worked very hard to be more concerned about recovery by nutrition on the front end. You're taught to try to carb up the night before, and I learned that early on, but I learned that didn't work for me. So I eat as much as I can the days a week before each race and the week after. And that has worked for me. I had, zero cramping in neither race. I didn't hit the wall. I didn't, of course, maintain the pace that I wanted to after the first half. But I finished both races in around 4 hours and 20 minutes. So I felt good. My recovery was great. This is, the week after. And I'm, ready to run again.
You got any other races coming up?
I had promised myself just to chill out because at mile 9 of the Marine Corps, a week after I did the Baltimore race, I was like, maybe this wasn't a good idea. But that was then. I finished, in the same time, same pace as I did the week before. And there are a couple other races that that I'd like to consider. One that's in Richmond that I've always wanted to do. And then a local race is the NCR Trail Marathon that I've done before, but I have a few friends running it. And it's a flat race, so I'm thinking about one of those. So we'll see how it works out.
NCR, is that the one up near the Hunt Valley area?
Exactly. It's, I think it's in
Sparks?
Sparks, Maryland, yeah.
Okay.
Right. It's along the NCR Trail. I think it goes all the way to Pennsylvania and back. It's very flat, though. There is a little hill when you are coming back on the road, but the trail is extremely flat, and it's soft because it's off-road, and it's a big race. It's the end of the last race marathon at the end of the year here in this area, and a lot of people participate. And it's like a reunion.
How did you train for your marathon?
I trained. This was a tough year for me because my father was ill, and we found out he had esophageal cancer in February. And I was back and forth home to Alabama a lot during that period, so I didn't get the structured training that is necessary. I didn't do a lot of the local races this year that I usually do. But I try to get up to 20 miles on a long run 2 weeks out from the race. I was able to accomplish that. I do a speed training in my neighborhood in Howard County with the Howard County Striders, and I kept pretty good at that, and that worked out well. And I did my maintenance endurance runs during the week and long runs on the weekend. It kind of worked out. And like I said, I really was focused a lot on nutrition, and I try to keep a lot of good people around me to help me run, and I help them, and that's always a lot of fun.
Cool. Now let's talk more about nutrition. Do you have a specific eating regimen, or are you vegan or vegetarian?
I'm a vegetarian. My family and I, we're all vegetarians. We eat a little salmon and for brain food, because my sons are 9. We were kind of concerned about that.
They're both 9 years old?
Right. They're twin boys.
Oh.
And Hudson and Harrison. And but I eat up during training periods. I really munch on avocados often because, you know, I'm a, you know, hard gainer. So I try to, you know, I'm not ever really concerned about my weight, but I don't want to, you know, appear to be
hard. I'm sorry. When you say hard gainer, do you mean it's hard for you to gain weight?
It's hard for me. I'm not like a lot of people. I'm not going to sit around and get fat. when I was into really trying to sculpt and build or bulk up,
yeah,
I had to eat consistently to both build muscle and to maintain it. And I did very little running during that period. And so I have to really keep good fats in my body, you know, a consistent stream of proteins. And I eat a lot of carbs because I am a vegetarian. I believe in eating live food and local food. I have a lot of that at my disposal. So I just eat whatever, you know, in that realm of things, it's all good and it's all nutritious. So I eat as much as I can. And I enjoy, you know, cheesecake every now and then. I like,
you have a cheat meal Rocky every once in a while.
I cheat a lot. I would, you know, I'm not a purist either. I just know that, I like Rocky Road. I don't have any bad feelings about that. And I like cheesecake every now and then, even though cheesecake is a pie. It's what they call cheesecake. I like the taste of it. And that's kind of my, you know, guilty pleasure. And when we're on the road with my family, I eat Nutty Bars. So that's kind of how I guess if that's cheating, I cheat with those. And I also like mangoes.
All right. Well, we're talking about you now. Let's go back a little bit. Where are you from?
I'm from a little town called Elba, Alabama. It's in southeast Alabama, and that's where I grew up.
Did you go to school there?
Yeah, I went to, high school. I went to the city system. It's a small rural town, so I was in my city system until high school, and I went to Troy University after I graduated from high school.
Is Troy in Alabama?
Yeah, Troy is a stone's throw away. It's maybe 40, 50 miles away from my town. And it was one of the options I had.
Was Elba one of those typical southern towns where y'all were real big into football?
Yeah. The answer is yes. football is the biggest, sport. There were others. I played baseball, and I was in the marching band. But I was also a sports writer, so I had, you know, good relationships with all the football players. And I was an athlete as well. And we all grew up together. It's small, so, you know. And the year that I finished high school, my contemporaries, they won the state championship. So that's kind of one of the memories of high school for all of us.
Good. When you were in college, were you part of any teams or any organizations?
I didn't play any sports. I kind of focused on, you know, I thought college for me was to learn how to do organizing. And so I was in the SGA. I pledged Alpha Phi Alpha fraternity as a freshman. I was involved with the student Black Student Union there called African American Alliance. And I was kind of, you know, consistent with trying to be involved with politics and community outreach at the level that I had it. I thought that's why that was the purpose for those organizations. So I tried to maximize my time to learn, you know, how to organize and how to do outreach and how to, be about the uplift of people who were in need.
When you finished college, did you immediately get into the political arena, or what happened? What was your journey from college to – we'll get to Park Heights in a little bit, but
right.
Yeah, what did you do after college?
I graduated on a Friday, and on Wednesday I was in Washington, D.C.
Really?
So that answers your question. During that period, I graduated in 1994, and the most exciting thing – for young people who were Democrats during that period was the election of Bill Clinton in 1992. And for me, the fact that Ron Brown was the chair of the party and a lot of, and you know, what Bill Clinton brought to the stage were a lot of African Americans who were in leadership, and Ron Brown was one of those people, and I was excited by him. I was excited by Alexis Herriman, who was actually from Alabama, and others. Mike Espy was the Secretary of Agriculture, and Jocelyn Elders was Surgeon General. So there were a lot of these African-American images that we didn't have before that time, because the Reagan and Bush administration didn't do a lot to promote that type of energy or attraction for black folks. And I wanted to be in D.C. I mean, I looked at running for public office at home, and the chances of that didn't look good. But I wanted to be in the center of it. So, like I said, on Friday, I graduated. On Wednesday, the following Wednesday, I was in D.C., and I wanted to learn how to do politics. I thought that was a place, and I ended up in the middle of it. You know, I didn't get a job right away in politics. In fact, it was I thought I would work on the Hill and that kind of thing. I didn't know what I was asking for, but I thought that was a gradual progression, and I didn't have the real contacts and network to do it for me. So, and then it didn't matter, because in November of that year, the Democrats were washed out of the House and the Senate. It was a Republican takeover at that time. And I just went and started doing work in the community, and, you know, got deeply involved with the Young Democrats and the local Democratic Party in D.C. and worked hard in the community.
How long did you stay in D.C. for?
I was there for, I guess, 6 or 7 years, and I met my wife in 2001, and I eventually moved to Baltimore, and that was, you know, kind of a short story about that. But during the time that I was in D.C., I was, like I said, very active with the Democratic Party. I was the president of the Young Democrats in the city, and very active nationally with the Young Democrats of America. And on top of that, because of that network, I was able to do a lot of national campaigns. I ended up being the political director for D.C. for the Gore campaign in 2000. And before that, I actually left D.C. to work in Mississippi for a time. And that was an experience that I'll never forget.
Well, was it good, bad?
It was traumatizing. But what I learned was that, you know, I thought I went there to fight Republicans, but there was so much party infighting that I never even got to that. There was not one strategy meeting on how to beat Republicans. It was just a consistent fight internal. But I learned from that you have to organize within before you can really galvanize, you know, outside. And that was a good lesson for me. I didn't understand it at the time. I just wanted to get out of town. So I spent probably 6 months in Mississippi, and I got out of town as soon as I could. And ironically, even though I was there for a short period of time, when I was leaving town, and I mentioned earlier about Mike Espy, who was the Secretary of Agriculture, and he was basically ousted. He went back home to Mississippi. And on my way out of town, I just happened to see him walking in the downtown area. So I pulled over and gave him a ride. I was like, "Where you want to go?" It was the weirdest thing. And he had, I guess he had to rebrand himself and rebuild. And at the time, he told me he was studying French. And I was like, wow. And what that told me, though, and I, you know, I dapped him up. I left town, and I've only been back to Jackson, Mississippi once since then. But what it, you know, I kind of took that as a message that you just, you know, you can't give up regardless of what happens to you. You can't give up. You got to keep pushing. And regardless of how you get, if you keep the energy that you had to get to the race, you just got to keep pushing in the middle of it. And I guess I don't know what he's doing now. But he, at that time, it inspired me to keep doing what I was doing, even though I didn't have the greatest experience professionally in Mississippi or with politics.
You start out in Alabama, go to D.C., go to Baltimore, kind of make a pit stop in Mississippi. And then when you came back to Baltimore, when you came back to Baltimore from Mississippi, is that when?
Well, actually, I went back to D.C.
Oh, you went back to D.C.
That was 1996. So I spent that period until 2001, just doing DC politics. And then in 2001, I met my wife, mm-hmm. Kimberly Ampre, at the time, Kimberly Flowers, and I moved to DC. I mean, moved to Baltimore, and kind of started all over. It was a different place. I thought it was, the contacts and connections were the same, but they're completely different. And but I had a interesting experience, in Baltimore, and it was all good in retrospect. And we're kind of still here. I mean, I eventually moved to Howard County, Maryland. My sons were born in 2006, and they were actually born in D.C. And we moved to Howard County, and we've been there ever since.
I did a little bit of research about Park Heights, and it was kind of mired in, I don't know if I can really say controversy, but plainly put, the previous executive director was indicted for fraud. Mm-hmm. What compelled you to take over Park Heights? Did somebody offer the job to you, or did you just see an opportunity? What was your reason behind that?
Well, before I was in the position of executive director, I was in government affairs at Sinai Hospital, or LifeBridge Health, and it was the case that I was, basically a lobbyist for the hospital, and I learned development there. But it was also the case that I was driving through the Park Heights community and didn't feel like I was doing anything to help with the clear challenges that existed there with social determinants, whether it's housing, transportation challenges, and clear just physical challenges with people. And I just thought I was a healthcare lobbyist, but I wasn't really doing anything to help the people in the community. So at some point, I was detailed because the Sinai Hospital, or LifeBridge Health, helped to found the Park Heights Community Health Alliance. So I was detailed to run the organization. And that was in 2009. It was a surprise to me, but I felt like it was an opportunity to help people in the Park Heights community. And that was in 2009. It was kind of out of just an opportunity. And as it pertains to the former executive director, it was just an unfortunate situation. We kind of bounced back from it. The good thing was that we are still here. And that was, going on 8 or 9 years ago. And we didn't have a lot of programming at the time when I took over. Didn't have a lot of anything at the time. We built the programs. We have a lot of things to facilitate to kind of sustain us now. And the rest is history. I mean, it was a challenging period because I had to make a lot of decisions that were leadership decisions at that time to keep the organization afloat. And we're still here.
What do you think the most difficult part of running a nonprofit is, especially running a nonprofit in a predominantly Black neighborhood in Baltimore?
It's just accepting the fact that you are going to be making a lot of decisions on your own that affect a lot of people. If you make them and they're good results, everybody celebrates. If they are not so good, you're to blame. So I've tried to learn to be incremental in whatever we do, and the steps that we've taken over the years have helped to build a structure for programming that we can raise money around and try to facilitate recruiting young people to work with us who are idealistic and kind of see the vision of what we are trying to do.
Gotcha. You guys have any future projects coming up that you can talk about?
Right now we started a computer coding class for young people under 18, which teaches introduction to computer coding languages so that we can encourage young people to become computer programmers or coders, and there's a whole industry based on that. We have the third annual Brassica Festival, which is our conference on food. It guides people around this issue of food access, sustainability, and just, you know, growing your own food. We have a lot of fun with that every year. We have two significant speakers who were who've been invited and accepted, and one is Majora Carter out of the Bronx, New York, and the other is Byron Hurt, who is the director of Soul Food Junkies. We also have a strong mindfulness structure with what we do with the program, and what that means is that we have weekly or evening activities around modalities that we think if people connect with, they can find their own personal transformation. And that includes Tai Chi, it includes yoga, and also meditation. So, and we're also going to be introducing a study group for A Course on Miracles in 2016. So it's been very, it's been good to try to do those types of programs that I think are beneficial to a community that is challenged with the social determinants of health overall.
I want to talk a little bit more about politics because you have experience in that arena. If you look at the political climate now, you were talking about infighting when you were down in Mississippi. What's your opinion on the current political climate and also the current presidential race?
The local climate is... it's kind of confusing. I think the only other time that Baltimore City could have been in a situation like this could have been in 1968 after those riots. And in that situation, the mayor stepped down and actually the governor stepped up. And a lot of people aren't talking about that. But the mayor stepped down, and I don't know what happened following that, but I didn't, you know, I'm sure that the African American participation was not at the level of influence as it is now. But so as it pertains to now, I just think that it's things have just culminated into this type of anxiety across the board. Young people feel anxiety. Now, business people are doing business as usual, unfortunately.
What does that mean?
And that means that they, the week after the uprising, the riots, whatever people call it, they ran a story in the Baltimore Business Journal, and it kind of gave this false sense that nothing was wrong. Even though this city almost burned down, they did a Baltimore Business Journal story and, you know, galvanized a lot of the leaders and business leaders, and they like, we're still one Baltimore. Well, I couldn't disagree more. I mean, in fact, I don't think there's ever been one situation where there was an effort to pull everyone together. And as you know, that was a very challenging period. And there was never an attempt to promote what we think the solution is, and that's basically to promote love, understanding, forgiveness even, and unity at that time. A lot of people said it, but there were no physical aggressive actions to bring the entire city together. So there's still anxiety. I see all of the social media posts. You see the stuff in the media. Unfortunately, the murder rate of young black men mostly is on the rise. I think it was at 280 or something. So I don't, until that stuff is figured out, until everybody's at the table to try to say what they can contribute and what they see as a vision, or if there's a strong vision, someone with big ideas, I think that there's going to be that type of anxiety, uncertainty about what's going on with the city. There should be a progressive way to try to inspire people toward jobs and workforce development. There should be some step taken to try to guide some confidence in what education is about, or redefine what education is about, particularly at the younger ages. And I don't really see any one individual who you want to see as a leader doing that who's in public office now. And that's needed. I mean, the confidence is needed. The only exciting thing I hear about that's kind of a change in the city are the lines at the horseshoe. And that speaks volumes about the priorities of a city. So I hope that energy can be placed into what we do in the communities, because outside of projects that are private based and inspired by people with money of their own, the city, you know, housing, for example, I don't know what programs they do that kind of guide people to the security that they need as it pertains to the subject matter of home ownership and that type of thing. And I think everybody deserves that.
How much of the change that's needed in the city, how much of that do you think is on the residents of the city itself?
Well, I think that people, there's a lack of trust across the board. And a lot of it, I mean, I would say it's you know, all of it is based on it. Whether it's good or bad, the people in the communities feel the effect of it. And you feel it through the reality of your property value. There are people in the Park Heights community, for example, who made investments 40 years ago in homes that don't cost, half of what they pay, way less than half of what they pay for them. So they can't get the money out of them if they wanted to at this time. So, and that's because of the obvious signs of redlining, the obvious signs of land banking and this kind of stuff.
Can you explain what land banking is?
So land banking in the positive is when the government or a private investor buys parcels of property so that they can acquire, for example, a block. But unfortunately, if there's a holdout, what you do and do that in that situation, because nobody's living in those houses, is that the value of the home goes down. So the person is almost forced to sell out to get something out of the deal. So they land bank, and some people do it strategically. The government does it strategically so that they can acquire land to do certain things with. But sometimes it's done in a passive way, because there are developers who just buy the land and wait for people to move out, sell out, or be drained out. And it becomes negative then. And in a lot of cases in Park Heights, for example, in other neighborhoods in the city, there are just absentee landlords who, I guess in most cases they're paying their taxes, but for the most part they just are neglectful and don't have a concern about what their absenteeism is doing to the neighborhood. So land banking could be a good strategy, but in most cases it's a bad strategy. And that sets into the effect is called redlining, when you reduce the value of everything and, individuals can't get, equity out of their properties. But simultaneously, or at the same time, the prices are, the property value, property taxes continue to go up. And the assessments are also going up.
What do you think the future of Park Heights will be?
Well, I mean, everybody's uncertain about that. There hasn't been a clear vision of what specifically is going to happen. The organization that leads the quote-unquote Park Heights master plan implements it is the Park Heights Renaissance. Everyone's waiting for a strong vision about what specifically will happen. That hasn't happened. I was in a community meeting a few weeks ago, and the leader of that organization basically said that the city doesn't know what to do with Park Heights. And if that is confidence, I don't know what that is. But okay. The point is, there are a lot of assets with the community that can be focused on. A lot of those assets came out in the Park Heights Master Plan. There's a lot of things to point at as value. I mean, you have it's 5 minutes from downtown. The train is there. There's a significant bus line there. The MARC train is not far away. I mean, we're not far from Druid Hill Park, Gwynn's Falls Trails, and Sinai Hospital. There are a lot of assets to the community that are not being built on. It's a significant gateway that can be produce, not just coming from south from Park Circle, but also from Cold Spring over Loyola.
Yeah.
Is there. So there's a lot of assets that have not, I don't think, been played on as attractions for people to really invest in the community. There's a lack of, there is no real retail. So I think that if those types of things are put into play, things can happen. And to facilitate, and the goal is to facilitate people who are going to buy houses and pay taxes.
Hey, everybody, don't worry. There's nothing wrong with your phone or your computer. The episode with Mr. Flowers cut off abruptly because the mic I was using was having some trouble. Still, I want to thank Mr. Flowers for sitting down with me. You can learn more about Park Heights Community Health Alliance by visiting their website, phca.org. Follow Local Color on Facebook, facebook.com/localcolorabp, and follow us on Twitter, @localcolor410. Instagram for Local Color is forthcoming, eventually, please, be patient. Until then, see you guys next time.